For almost 40 years, DR Power Equipment has been the go-to for homeowners who want professional-level outdoor power equipment. Whether you're managing acres of overgrown fields or just want to have the best lawn on the block, DR Power has everything you need to conquer your piece of the outdoors. Visit drpower.com today to learn more and shop the sale.
Taking Stock with Mandy Johnston.
Brought to you by PwC
on News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Taking Stock. I'm Mandy Johnston. I'll be keeping you company here on News Talk for the next hour or so as we look at some of the major stories in business and politics here in Ireland and around the world. Coming up on today's show, John Adams once called the US Vice Presidency the most insignificant office ever conceived. But that office has been an integral part of some of the most consequential chapters in US history. Later on in the show, I'll be chatting to Joel Goldstein. He's a professor emeritus at the St. Louis University. He's also the author of a book on the US vice presidency. It's called The White House, The Path to Significance. And over in the UK this week, Chancellor Rachel Reeves set out a series of incredibly tough choices to fill a £22 billion fiscal hole that she said she's found since taking office. George Parker is the political editor for the Financial Times, and he'll be joining me to discuss what that will look like for the government and indeed for the people of the UK. And finally, just how committed is business to pursuing the green agenda? Peter Stapleton from Green Scene and Raquel Noboa, who is CEO of 50 Shades of Green, will join me later to discuss. If you want to email me about any of today's topics, you can do so on takingstock@newstalk.com. I'm also open on Twitter at StockNT. Well, the honeymoon is well and truly over for the UK Chancellor Rachel Reeves, as earlier this week, she used a set piece in the House of Commons to tell the UK about a £22 billion fiscal hole that she claims the Conservative Party hid during the recent election campaign. I'm delighted to be joined now by George Parker, the political editor of the Financial Times. George, thanks for being with us today.
Pleasure.
Now, there's lots of numbers sloshing around here, George, but you do get the sense that there's a highly political narrative creation going on all sides. Maybe start us off with the Chancellor herself, what she said she discovered this week.
Yeah, I mean, this is a very political exercise, as you say. So Rachel Reeves is the new Chancellor of the Exchequer. And what she's done is what all incoming finance ministers do, which is basically have a look at the books and discover they're so much worse than they could possibly have imagined before the election. And that's exactly what Rachel Reeves has done. So it's a bit like the builders coming in and saying, well, you've had a cowboy in here, haven't you? And suddenly the bill starts racking up. And what she did on Monday, she came to the House of Commons and she said she'd conducted a quickfire audit of all the government's unfunded, as she saw it, spending commitments. These are commitments made by Rishi Sunak's former Conservative government. And she came up with a pretty big number, £22 billion, which she said hadn't been funded. She said this was shocking, that she'd been left to clear up the mess. And what it essentially was a softening up exercise, I think many people felt, for tax rises to come in the autumn when she has her first budget.
Mm. Well, she's not having that narrative all her own way. Jeremy Hunt is equally offended by all of this, her predecessor claiming that this is a slight on the officials.
Yeah, I mean, Jeremy Hunt, there's a lot at stake here because this isn't just a row for now. This is a row that the Labour government hopes will still be knocking around in 4 or 5 years' time when we have the next general election, because what they want to do is plant in the public's mind that the Conservative Party ran the public services into the ground, that they were totally irresponsible. And Jeremy Hunt, as the former Chancellor, Conservative Chancellor, is determined to fight back on this front. So he's saying, well, look, hang on a sec. You know, these numbers were signed off by officials. Are you saying the officials were lying? And Rachel Reeves has replied by saying that Jeremy Hunt is himself a liar. It's all been extremely unedifying, to be frank. But their eyebrows have been raised about the sums that Rachel Reeves has come up with. And a lot of people do think it's quite a cynical exercise, really, to prepare the country for tax rises that Rachel Reeves gave the impression, at least before the election, wouldn't be coming down the track.
Mm. And of course, his claim is that she knew about this all along and that this is no new big reveal. But like, tell us, George, about the antidote to all of this from her perspective. What did she set out that the government would be doing to deal with this big fiscal hole?
Yeah, well, what she's... I should just say, first of all, the £22 billion fiscal hole. A lot of it is accounted for by the fact the government has decided to honour in full the public sector pay recommendations made by an independent body. The pay rises are between 5 and 6%. That adds up to about £10 billion of the £22 billion. So, you know, half of this really is a political choice by Rachel Reeves give people a pay rise. Lots of people think they deserve that, but nevertheless, that was a very much part of the calculation. In terms of what she's intending to do to close the hole, well, a lot of it will have to be closed in the autumn when we have her first budget, and that's when we expect the tax rises to come. But in the meantime, she took what was seen as quite a difficult decision, which was to turn on better off pensioners, excuse me, who basically receive universal winter fuel payments. This was something that was introduced by a previous Labour government, worth about £300 to older pensioners, regardless of their wealth. She's basically targeting that now on only the poorest, very poorest pensioners. So she's taking money away from pensioners. She's decided to scrap a few flagship road projects, including the almost fabled plan to build a tunnel underneath the Stonehenge World Heritage Site, which has been talked about for decades, as long as I've been driving down that road. And she's also announced plans to review a plan to rebuild 40 hospitals, which Boris Johnson had announced, and for which Rachel, you said there was no funding allocated. So some quite big decisions taken on Monday already. But again, a large part of that hole still has to be filled. And that's where these tax rises in the autumn come in.
Mm. Yeah, you mentioned some of the commitments that she's already invested in herself, which is paying that, inflation plus wage increase to the NHS and some of the doctors there. So you've got this kind of union-based investment versus well-off pensioners. So does that kind of play into the Labour Party base, really?
It does. I mean, you look at it in two ways. I mean, the first thing, as you say, that there was this 5 or 6% pay rise for most public sector workers. But on top of that, there was a 22% pay rise over 2 years for junior doctors who've been on strike now for a couple of years, causing chaos in the National Health Service. So one of the first things this Labour government has done is basically settled that pay dispute, but at the cost of a very large pay rise indeed. Now, that could store up problems for Rachel Reeves in the future when public sector unions come to negotiate their next pay round next year. And they say, well, we'd rather like some of that 22% as well, thanks very much. So there's potential problems ahead for her on that front. But as you say, you know, giving money to public sector workers is the kind of thing you expect a Labour government to do. Taking money away from better off pensioners, frankly, is almost an inevitable political choice for Rachel Reeves. If you look at the way that people vote in the UK, the only age group that vote overwhelmingly for the Conservative Party nowadays are people aged over 70, typically better off people aged over 70. And, you know, if you're looking for potential targets, I would have thought people with assets, people who are better off in their 70s, may not be around to vote for much longer either, will be very much in the sights of Rachel Reeves.
And you mentioned there, George, at the outset that, look, this could all be really about preparing people for the worst that's to come, and maybe the idea that there'll be tax increases. I don't think she's shying away from the fact that that's what she's trying to do here, is to tee people up for even more tough measures that are on the way in the budget. Do you think that they're early enough on in the government and strong and solid enough in their numbers to kind of withstand this? And is that really what this is about? Get in early, get the really tough stuff done, and then start working on your legacy, your record in 4 or 5 years' time?
Yeah, I mean, it's very well-trodden path, this, isn't it? I'm sure you have the same in Ireland, where governments come in. They do the tax rises and all the difficult decisions right at the start of the parliament, when they've got a bit of political capital in the bank. And while they can still conceivably blame it all on the last lot, that's exactly what Rachel Reeves has done. And then the hope is you put the public finances back on a sounder footing. And if all your other policies work and growth returns, then hopefully, as the next election starts to come into view, you start to give some of that money back through tax cuts. So that's very much the plan. And you could see it almost coming from outer space. Before the election, economists across the country and newspapers like the Financial Times were pointing out that this whole debate, the whole election was held on a false premise, really, which was that the country could afford tax cuts or very limited tax rises. The public sector in this country is in a terrible state. We've got 7.5 million people waiting on hospital waiting lists. There's pressure on the defence budget to counter the threat of Russia. The population's getting older. There's a social care crisis. The prisons are so full, we're having to let prisoners out of prison. The whole public realm is in a terrible mess. And frankly, whoever won the election was going to have to put up taxes, despite the claims that were being made during the campaign.
And of course, the big promise of the Labour Party coming into this was growth and a return to a positive economy. And so will these type of tough love measures do anything to help that? Are we seeing a kind of an increased positive in interest from the markets?
Well, I think the markets are sort of looking at the Labour government and hoping that they're going to come in and introduce sort of growth-focused policies. And the first part of that, the first part of the sort of central part of Rachel Reeves's message, really, is that stability has changed. So what she wants to do is reassure the markets she's going to put the public services back on a sound footing. She's going to stabilise the public finances. And she's going to go for growth. She's going to go for policies which basically deliver the growth. That's really the only way we can solve our public service problem, which is to get the economy growing at, instead of growing at 1.5% a year, growing at 2.5% a year. And so they've already announced a number of things they want to do in that area, including investing in green power, tearing up large parts of the sclerotic planning system we have in the UK, which stops people building houses in large parts of the country. So it's a sort of combination of things, really. She's hoping that in the end, she'll be able to bring the tax burden down by getting the economy to grow faster. And that's what the market's looking for.
Now, beyond Jeremy Hunt's reaction to this, because if he of course, is trying to safeguard his own legacy, but what about the public reaction to this? Has there been any pushback against them in the media? Has there been a public debate on foot of what she has announced and what she signalled to come in October?
Well, I mean, I think you said at the start that the honeymoon period's over. I think probably the honeymoon period's got a bit longer to run for the Labour government. I mean, they've just come in with a 400 out of 650-odd seats. They've got the biggest majority in recent times. The public really, the move was really across the country was for change. You know, everyone you speak to, whether it's businesses or ordinary voters, even some Conservative MPs recognised the country needed change, that the last government had run out of steam. It was exhausted. And so there is still some goodwill in the bank for the Labour government. I think Keir Starmer has made a good start. He looks like a prime minister. Rachel Reeves, you know, has done the sort of tough love stuff, which is kind of what you would expect. So I think they've got a bit more, they've got a bit more goodwill in the bank for a while, at least. That's what they're certainly counting on. In terms of the negative public reaction, there's been some criticism from groups representing pensioners, for sure. I see that the Daily Telegraph, the cheerleader for the Conservative Party, is saying we've just had a glimpse of the grotesque future, as they put it, which Rachel Reeves has in mind for the country. But generally, it's sort of gone through without a great deal of fuss. And, you know, it has to be borne in mind that most of the country now is on holiday and all of the country is fed up to the back teeth with politics, to be honest. We've overdosed on it in the last few months Everybody's, I think, wants a break, and they're probably tuning a lot of this out.
I think so. Unfortunately, it's not going to stop us talking about it for another few minutes. Just turning to the Conservative Party for a moment, what is happening there in terms of the leadership, or who might go forward for that, and when is that likely to come to a conclusion?
Yes, well, they've now set the rules for the leadership contest. Nominations have closed. There are six candidates vying for the pleasure of replacing Rishi Sunak. The contest is going to take place over a few months. Over August, candidates are going to be sort of going up and down the country trying to find any Tory activists who are not on holiday to lobby them. And then at the end of August, when MPs come back from their summer break, Conservative MPs will whittle down the list of six candidates to four. Those four will then go through to a beauty parade at the Conservative Party conference in the beginning of October. Then the Conservative MPs will whittle down the list of four down to two. And those two candidates on the final shortlist will be put out to the party membership. And it's worth bearing in mind, of course, as we've seen in the past, that the party membership is quite right-wing, certainly more right-wing than the party's MPs, and very much more right-wing than the country's electorate as a whole. And therein lies the problem for the Conservatives. There's always a danger that they could elect another Liz Truss, which is probably not what the country wants at the moment.
Any notion or would you care to hazard a guess at who the two final might be in your view?
Well, I mean, I can tell you who the bookmakers have as the favourites at the moment. Number one, and actually someone who's made a very strong start to this contest, is someone called Robert Jenrick, who was a former immigration minister. He used to be seen as sort of a moderate sort of Cameroonian, sort of moderate conservative. He then became extremely right-wing on the question of immigration. He thought the country had been let down by politicians. He advocates all kinds of tough measures, including being an advocate of the now junked Rwanda policy. He's come from pretty much nowhere, really, to be the favourite in this contest, ahead of Kemi Badenoch, who is the former business secretary, very, very combative minister. The Guardian newspaper this week carried allegations that she bullied staff in her old department. She says it's a smear campaign, being put up by her rivals. Already you can see that's starting to turn a bit nasty. And I think if you were looking for someone who would be a bit more centrist, James Cleverly, the former foreign secretary, or Tom Tugendhat, who's a former security minister, who, although he tries to disguise it, I think is one of the very few, if not the only candidate in that list who actually supported Britain staying inside the European Union.
That's right. He was somebody who advocated for that and very aware we would be of his stance on it here in Ireland. Just, you mentioned there the goodwill toward this government. Keir Starmer hit the ground running with an outreach to the Irish government, which is very welcome from this side of the Irish Sea and something that we look forward to building on, I'm sure. George, listen, thank you very much for taking the time to give us your insights today. That was George Parker, political editor of the Financial Times. You're listening to News Talks Taking Stock. After the break, we'll be delving into whether business remain committed to their role in climate action, and I'll be uncovering what the secret of metro city life is. Stay tuned.
DR Power Equipment is the industry leader in field and brush mowers. Their full line of machines are designed to clear acres of tough weeds, woody brush, and saplings up to 3 inches thick, hour after hour, year after year. Just one mow, and you'll agree nothing stops a DR. Visit drpower.com to learn more and shop the sale today.
You're welcome back to News Talks Taking Stock. I'm Mandy Johnston. Now, businesses are constantly told to up their green credentials, but just how invested are businesses actually about going about achieving this, and how interested are they still in the ESG issue? Or is that on the wane? Well, joining me now to discuss is Peter Stapleton of Green Scene and Raquel Noboa, who is CEO of 50 Shades Greener. You're both very welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having us on.
Raquel, I'm going to start with you because that's a very intriguing name of the company, 50 Shades Greener. Who are you and what exactly do you do?
Yeah, so we're an educational company for sustainable development. Obviously, everybody remembers the name, but really the whole purpose of it is to give, you know, this motivation that there isn't just one green. There is different shades of green. There is different variations and different stages that businesses will go through when trying to green their operations. So we provide education and training for businesses, but also for colleges and universities and even governments.
So, Peter, just to bring you in here, lots of different ways that people can try and up their green credentials, if you like, and their ESG targets and all of that. You're somebody who's working in that space with businesses on a day-to-day basis. Tell us about Green Scene and what exactly it is that you do.
Yeah, so Green Scene is a family business that's been around for just over 40 years, founded by my father, Richard Stapleton, and it provides live plants into the hospitality, office, and other commercial spaces, and maintains those live plants over their lifetime. So obviously with the climate crisis, with biodiversity crisis out there, built up awareness amongst the public and business over the last 20 years, but particularly in the last 10 years, we've seen that increase of awareness from our customer base. And so I suppose we've kind of developed with that, where originally, you know, we might have been putting one small plant into the office reception area. Now, all of a sudden, it's very much the focus of buildings when they go to be designed, go to be developed, is how can they bring more biodiversity into their own space.
So that's something that they're thinking about from the get-go when they're planning architecture and all that kind of stuff, how to get biodiversity into the working environment.
Yeah, 100%. And we deal a lot with then architects, builders from the very start before the customer necessarily even or the tenant comes on board in office spaces. But it is being driven by that customer demand.
And what type of clients would you be working with?
So a range. We'll work with some of the biggest multinationals right down to small coffee shops. But I suppose here in Dublin, you know, we work with Salesforce. We did Salesforce's new office there in the last kind of 24 months. We're part of that whole design and installation. We'll work with Amazon, LinkedIn, MasterCard, some other iconic hotels or hospitality sites that people might recognise. We do the window boxes in St. Stephen's Green, and then we do the Ivy restaurant as well. We'd have a lot of plants outside of it that people might recognise, some large green walls and the Gibson Hotel. Or if people recognise the restaurant from the First Dates program, we do all the
okay. So we'd be familiar with your product and what you do. Raquel, I want to bring you back in here. So there's a very practical application of a company working with businesses on a very varied scale, small businesses right through some of those global names we heard. Pre-pandemic, the green agenda was at the top of every single political list. It was a big deal for business as well. Now we've had the pandemic, wars on the doorstep of Europe, cost of living crisis. Do you think, as someone who's operating in this space, that it's something that has slipped down the priority list for business leaders? Are companies falling behind a little bit on their ESG targets? Or is it, as you see it, generally less or more important than it was, say, 2 or 3 years ago?
Not really. I have seen a big shift this year, possibly due to the EU directive, the CSRDs. It's come into legislation in Ireland now at the beginning of July. And I think that has put enormous pressure on business owners to finally start doing something. I do think that pre-pandemic, this was big on the agenda of governments and it was big on the agenda of the media, but it still wasn't really seeping into those business owners of large and small companies. Obviously, with the pandemic, we're all in survival mode and it was how is the business going to survive? So it just completely slipped the mind of a lot of people. And obviously, even to the media, just reported on the pandemic more than climate change. But since the pandemic now has been, restored to regular levels now, I do see a huge increase. But I believe one of the biggest motivators or one of the biggest reasons is the CSRD. So, it starts with legislation. This legislation needs to happen so that it becomes as important as health and safety became, in construction 15 years ago. It's the equivalent of that. We need the legislation so that businesses actually start really putting the measures in place.
And Raquel, once you see those, you're absolutely right, once you see those legislative rules in place and carbon budgets enforced by governments, you see business trying to change, and because it has to, it has no choice. What Peter's given us a good example of how some businesses can integrate that sustainability into their company culture from the get-go. What other things out there can business do to start kind of doing more on the ESG side of things from a business point of view?
Yeah, so obviously this answer might seem BS, but education and training for every employee in the organization, it's a must. A lot of the things of how humans impact the environment is due to our own behavior, is due to the habits that we have formed over a lifetime. But a person can't change their behavior if they don't know what it is that they need to change. Every worker in your supply chain has a part to play in the business sustainability strategy. And the mistake a lot of businesses are making is to either hire a consultant that will do their ESG report for them, or even just hire a person as an ESG director or manager and think that they've ticked the box, that this person, one person, is going to sort all this out. But the reality is, an ESG manager can only develop, measure, emissions, measure impact into nature and biodiversity and social impact, but they cannot actually apply the strategy that needs to be implemented, that needs to be implemented by every employee of the organization. So education and training, to me, is paramount. Nobody told us these things when we were learning our careers. Nobody told us, about the or use of energy or production of waste. So we can change those behaviors if somebody doesn't explain to us how.
Peter, just thinking about what your company does and how you help businesses, the urban greening or the idea of these green living parts of a building or a workforce, beyond making the place look nice, how do they actually help a company? Like, how can something like that being part of a company structure, physically, actually help the company, not just through the health of the workforce, but also from a carbon footprint? I'm trying to get at, is it literally the most extreme case of window dressing, or can it actually help?
It's a very good question. And I suppose our ability to go out there and sell and say, you know what, this is going to be a huge part of your environmental play as a business, and say, you know, we can drastically reduce your carbon emissions, would just be a falsehood. Mm. You know, we're actually playing a really small part in what the business can do to address their biodiversity. But I think even though it's small, it has a massive impact, again, to kind of Raquel's point about the culture within businesses, that they can see nature all around themselves, that they gain a greater respect for nature. And through that, then they gain a greater respect for what their company as a whole is having as an impact throughout their supply chain on biodiversity in the world. And that we obviously deal with big companies who will be doing big things to address their carbon emissions, to address biodiversity. They'll be planting millions of trees, you know, maybe in far distant places. I'm not going to stand here and say us putting a roof garden in is having more of an impact, you know, from a numerical point of view. But actually, in terms of the impact it can have on an organization's culture and awareness, it can be massive. Mm. And also, we wouldn't dismiss the kind of biodiversity is so complex, and so, you know, it's the interaction of different ecosystems, that, you know, we do like to refer to the butterfly effect, that, you know, if we're putting a roof garden in Dublin, in the middle of an urban city, we might have a beehive there as well. You know, they're pollinating plants that might not otherwise survive. They're cleaning the air. There's more species coming in. It can have bigger knock-on effects and impact as well.
Raquel, does that matter? Like, you know, if you can see it in a company, what it says about the company, is that important that these bigger global leaders kind of take a lead on this, and that by extension, other businesses might start to follow?
Yeah, absolutely. I think what Peter's company does is it's really, really important, particularly in cities, because I'm a firm believer that humans have lost their connection to nature. You know, there is people living in cities that might not get to see nature, you know, for the large majority of the year. And, you know, the simple fact of, you know, having those rooftop gardens or plants is good for biodiversity, it's good for our own mental health, nearly, you know, to be able to be closer to nature and touch it. So I think it's hugely important.
Mm. And then when you look at that, Peter, like the challenges of those businesses who are trying to balance like the economic side of investing in something like this, maybe take it down to some of the smaller businesses. If you're out there at the minute and you're a small business, maybe 5 or 10 employees, and you want to do more to say that culturally this company is sustainable and we're doing all those other bits and pieces that we can, what advice would you give to them if they were looking at sort of enhancing their space to try and make it more biodiversity friendly, if that's a way of putting it, not necessarily for your product, but just in general?
Yeah, well, I suppose there's lots that businesses, and also, I suppose, by extension, individuals can do in their own gardens, their own homes, to address and do their small bit to create more biodiverse spaces, to embrace nature more. And I suppose what I'd say, it does relate slightly to our products, but people will often think they're restricted for space. And that's why, you know, we don't have a big garden, so we can't do lots. But actually, there's products out there, there's green walls that can use very little space and all of a sudden get a huge density of live planting into them. And also not to be, I suppose, put down or prevented from doing something just because you think it's going to be small, that you're a small business and you're not going to have impact. It is the case that, look, every little helps. The more everyone can be doing to address this, the better. So just go for it.
Raquel, like, you've obviously been very successful since you've set up this company. Maybe just give us an idea of where you plan to go in the future, what you'd like to achieve with 50 Shades Greener. I can't say that enough.
Yeah, so my mission and that of my team is to help educate 8 billion people in the world. So not a small task, definitely not something that we can do by ourselves. And so we've been over the years trying to figure out ways, how do we get this done? How do we intervene in the educational systems to ensure that everybody is learning green skills? So one of the things that we're doing this year, we're developing a teacher sustainability program where we're going to be educating teachers how to embed green skills in their own curriculums, even training providers that work for private organizations and companies. They might go and deliver health and safety training, but there is a strength of sustainability that we can intervene into those training programs. What we're trying to do is, I guess, change the way we're teaching people, so to ensure that, you know, green skills at all levels, from social impact to environmental impact, are included in curriculums, and that people understand how their own actions can affect the environment or other people. Because if you know how your actions are affecting other people and the planet, we stand a better chance that people are going to change those behaviours and just live more sustainably.
Absolutely. Well, look, you've got a very busy agenda trying to educate 8 billion people, Raquel, so we won't take up any more of your time, but I really enjoyed talking to both of you. So thank you very much for joining me today. That was Peter Stapleton of Green Scene and Raquel Noboa, who's CEO of 50 Shades Greener. Thank you. You're listening to News Talk's Taking Stock. After the break, we'll turn our focus to the Office of the Vice President, featuring a discussion with the top US academic and leading author on the subject. Don't go anywhere.
DR Power Equipment is the industry leader in field and brush mowers. Their full line of machines are designed to clear acres of tough weeds, woody brush, and saplings up to 3 inches thick, hour after hour, year after year. Just one mow, and you'll agree nothing stops a DR. Visit drpower.com to learn more and shop the sale today.
You're welcome back to News Talk's Taking Stock. I'm Mandy Johnston. Now, it is a position which one incumbent once called useless, but its holder is just one breath away from perhaps the most important job in Western politics. That is, of course, the office of the US vice president. So in a modern age, just what is the role of the vice president of the United States? Well, I'm delighted to be joined now by Joel Goldstein. He is the author of a book called The White House Vice Presidency, The Path to Significance, Mondale to Biden. Joel, you're very welcome to News Talk. Thanks for joining us here.
Thanks very much for having me.
Now, Joe, when I started looking into this and reading a lot of the articles you've written about it, it's such a fascinating office because it's one thing during the campaign and then it's something completely different when it is in office. It has huge significance, not just for the United States, but, you know, a much wider global context at the moment. But you might start us off by the initial idea behind the vice presidency. How did it actually emerge within the setting up of the U.S. executive branch?
Well, the office was originally created in order to help the presidential election function. Initially, the electors were each given 2 votes for president, and the runner-up became vice president. That system was changed in 1804. And really, for most of our history, the main function of the vice president was to preside over the Senate, which wasn't a very demanding or fulfilling function. So, but the other role that really developed, especially in the 20th century, was the role of first presidential successor. On 9 occasions, vice presidents have become president, either when the president died or in one case when the president resigned. What's developed, though, in the last period since 1977, the Carter-Mondale term, has been that the vice president has become really an active part of the presidency. The vice president physically moved into the West Wing of the White House, was given access to the papers and to the meetings on the president's schedule, and in most administrations from both parties, has really played an active role as both a close presidential advisor and as a troubleshooter for the president, who takes on assignments that need to be handled at the highest level, both domestically assignments or international assignments, but that the president can't himself or herself handle.
Mm. And is there specific roles like that assigned to a vice president within the Constitution, or does it depend on what a sitting president wants the vice president to do?
No, it really very much depends and varies in each administration. While almost all of the recent vice presidents have been across the board advisors and governmental operators or troubleshooters, it varies in each administration depending upon the president's needs and how he or she organizes the administration, what are the vice president's skills and resources, and what's the context in which they serve? Mm. So the fact that one vice president does a particular function doesn't necessarily mean that his or her successor will do the same thing.
Mm. Now, let's go back a little bit. Before you are ever fortunate enough to become the vice president, you have to get elected, of course. So choosing a vice president in the running stages of a campaign is really important, because if you're successful, you've got to work with that person. But maybe tell us a little bit about the electoral considerations going into a campaign such as we are in 2024, that a sitting or former president or sitting vice president might think about when they're choosing their running mate.
Well, I think that's an important point, Mandy, because every vice presidential selection is made before and with the November election in mind. So it's natural and normal that presidential candidates will think about the political impact of a vice presidential selection before making the choice. So the vice presidential selection involves a very intensive vetting process, whereby vice presidential candidates are asked on paper and in personal interviews questions that one would never ask another person in any other context. The most personal questions, and they're asked not only of the prospective candidate, but also of the candidate's spouse, the candidate's family. And then in addition to this, there's really an investigation of the positions that the person has taken, the compatibility between the presidential candidate and the prospective vice presidential candidates, both politically and personally. And then there's consideration as to how they will perform on the national stage. The selection of a vice presidential candidate sends messages about the person who selects them. Mm-hmm. So presidential candidates are always thinking about, in part, about sending a message that they're a good decision maker, that they make good decisions, and that they know that when they choose a running mate, that will send information about the things that are important to them, what they value, and so forth.
Mm. I guess one of the reasons why that process is so invasive into the person's life is because campaigns themselves are extremely brutal. So you want to be sure that if there are any skeletons in the closet, you're not exposed to that by extension. And I don't want to talk about this campaign necessarily, but Donald Trump and obviously Kamala Harris now, their vice presidents are in the international psyche, if you like, because of how important this upcoming election is. But if you look at Donald Trump for a second, am I right in thinking in the past, historically, the president and vice president may be electorally a sort of yin and yang, and that in this instance, what we're seeing with Donald Trump is him largely doubling down on a Trump candidate, where I think historically, when you've looked at something, it's like trying to cover as many bases with the candidacy, if you like. Maybe talk us through that element of what has happened in the past.
Well, I think that's absolutely right, Mandy. And in fact, it's even true. I mean, there's a difference between the selection that Donald Trump made in 2016 when he chose Mike Pence, and the selection this time of J.D. Vance. When he chose Mike Pence, Trump was really reaching out, trying to broaden his appeal. So he picked somebody who was popular with the evangelical Christians, which is an important part of the Republican base. And he also, in picking Pence, was reaching out to somebody who had more credibility with sort of conventional Republican politicians than he did. So in a sense, in 2016, former President Trump made a more conventional pick. He was trying to broaden his ticket. This time, as you say, in choosing Senator J.D. Vance, he really doubled down on his MAGA philosophy and approach to government and to policy. Senator Vance, of all the possibilities, had been the one who had shown himself most willing to defend former President Trump on a wide range of matters, and to align his views closely with Trump. So, for instance, on January, with respect to January 6th, when there was the electoral count in the United States and number a mob of Trump supporters stormed the Capitol and disrupted the proceeding, Senator Vance, in different ways, was critical of Vice President Pence for his performance, said he would have acted differently, expressed doubt that Vice President Pence's life was really in danger, contrary to some of the indications from the Secret Service and otherwise. So that this time it seems that what Trump has done is pick somebody who really reinforces his MAGA approach. It's not unusual for a candidate to pick somebody who reinforces his or her politics. Bill Clinton did that when he chose Al Gore in 1992. But the difference is that when Clinton chose Gore, Clinton was a Democratic centrist who was choosing another Southern Democratic centrist fellow baby boomer. And together, the two of them sort of depicted sort of generational change. When Trump picks Senator Vance, he's really picking somebody doubling down on a position that's more to the extreme in Republican politics, rather than reaching out to, for instance, supporters of Ambassador Haley or to independents or to Democrats.
Yeah. And as you say, with the Al Gore appointment, then he went on to be incredibly successful with his own agenda from a policy perspective in his own right. But maybe go back to President Carter. And you said that President Carter, when he came in, the whole thing changed, really. His vice president then, Walter Mondale, took over more responsibilities. Was there a reason why Carter needed him to do more, or was that just the type of guy he was? He was more capable of delegating, or was there like issues of national importance that he needed extra help on?
I think it was all of those things, Mandy. It was to start with the kind of guy that Carter was, to use your formulation. Jimmy Carter had been before he went into politics. And really afterwards, he was a small businessman. He was a peanut farmer, and so as a small businessman, he really thought it was wasteful to not fully utilize all resources, to have a vice president and an office of vice president, and not being fully utilizing that personnel seemed wasteful to Carter. Carter also thought it was simply immoral to put the country in a position where the vice president, the first presidential successor, might come to office and not be fully informed of what was going on. He remembered that when Harry Truman became president, he wasn't aware of the Manhattan Project to build an atomic weapon until after he became president. And Carter thought that should never happen. So he wanted to involve his vice president. Carter had been a one-term governor of Georgia. He knew that he needed help in governing and dealing with Washington, in understanding how Washington worked, in having in establishing relations or dealing with Washington powerful figures, and also in dealing internationally. And then finally, when Carter went through the process of selecting his vice president, and he really sort of invented the modern selection process with the vetting and with the and he interviewed people. When he interviewed Walter Mondale, the two of them really hit it off. Politically, there were some differences. Mondale was more liberal than Carter, but whereas Carter was a born again Christian, Mondale was the son of a minister. They both had strong commitments to civil rights, to government transparency, to human rights, and they really hit it off immediately. And really, that relationship largely continued up until Mondale's death a couple of years ago when both of them were in their 90s.
Is it such an important part of it if you're working under that pressure that the relationship that you have will sustain? Before I let you go, Joel, I just wanted to ask you about looking as you have at the office itself in its totality. Who in your view has been successful in their achievements as vice president, but also in that relationship with the person at the helm who they're working with?
Well, I think there have been a number. I mean, I think that Joe Biden, I think, was a very significant vice president and very effective, and is both an advisor to President Obama and is a troubleshooter. I think Mondale really was the one who came up with a new vision and presented it to President Carter, or President-elect Carter at the time, and realized that what was important was not simply coming up with the vision, but figuring out what were the resources that the vice president would need in order to fulfill the vision. And Carter listened to it and basically said yes to everything that Mondale suggested, and then added a few other goodies like the West Wing office, and told people in the government that if anybody ever tried to sort of attack Mondale, that they would be displaced from their office, and he told them to treat any request from Mondale as if it were a request from Carter. I think those were two very effective ones. There have been others, I think Vice President Harris has been a consequential vice president in a different way. I mean, she's obviously been a historic figure as the first woman ever elected to national office in our history. But she's taken on the role in a very active way of publicly defending and being a spokesperson for ideas and programs that are important to the administration, as well as her foreign travel. Mm. So I think she's been effective. Vice President Cheney was very influential, especially in the first term. So I think there have been a number of very effective ones.
Well, Vice President or candidate Harris now has her own decisions to make in the coming weeks. And we hope that when the vice president's, whoever it is in situ after the election in November, you will join us again to give us your views on it. But for now, Joel Goldstein, thank you very much for joining us here on News Talk.
Thanks very much for having me.
Well, that's it for this episode of Taking Stock. And just a reminder that while we broadcast at this time on Sunday mornings, we're always available as a podcast first on Friday mornings on the News Talk app. My thanks to all of today's guests for their very valuable time and insights. Thanks also to the producer of Taking Stock this week, which was Simon Keane. Stephen Daunt was on research and Hugo Da Silva Scott was on sound. If you have any comments on any of today's items, do email us on takingstock@newstalk.com. Anton Savage is coming up next with all of your Sunday newspapers and lots, lots more. But for now, from me, Mandy Johnston, that was Taking Stock. Thank you for listening and enjoy the rest of your day.
Taking Stock with Mandy Johnston, Sunday morning at 9.
Brought to you by PwC
on News Talk.
DR Power Equipment is the industry leader in field and brush mowers. Their full line of machines are designed to clear acres of tough weeds, woody brush, and saplings up to 3 inches thick, hour after hour, year after year. Just one mow, and you'll agree nothing stops a DR. Visit drpower.com to learn more and shop the sale today.